Please be advised that the content in this episode is highly explicit, and caution and discretion should be taken when listening to this out loud in front of others, and especially in front of children. The material that we discuss in this episode is sensitive and unique from our other episodes. And again, I want to make sure before anyone begins to listen to this episode that they do so in the proper environment, and to please make sure that children or anyone who is not an adult should not be hearing this episode. The language and terminology and content that we discuss is meant for adults' ears only. Welcome to the Attached Life Podcast. You're listening to the Stories of Healing series. Each episode will give you a view into what inner healing looks like. Instead of just talking about therapeutic concepts, this series takes you inside the experience. Thank you for listening. Welcome to another Stories of Healing episode. I'm really looking forward to doing this episode because this is a first. This is very different than anything I've done so far. In the past, my Stories of Healing episodes have been monologues of me speaking about a fictionary conglomerate of clients and situations that I've worked with, and kind of creating a fictionary character and describing to you listeners of the work that I've done with that person. In this episode, I met recently a really amazing couple who has been through a journey of their own, and I'll explain what that journey is about in just a moment. And they agreed with voice changing technology and using different names to do a live episode with me of them telling their story, with me asking some questions. And at different points, I'll also talk about different phenomena and experiences that I've had working with people that may either be similar to what they describe or may be different than what they describe. And so, by way of introduction, very important to say that this episode, unlike all the other episodes, should be listened to with a lot more care, sensitivity, and choice, in the sense that it's going to be explicit and graphic, and it is adult content. And so anyone who's listening to this should make sure that this is something, that they feel comfortable listening to, and is to them something that makes sense for them to listen to. And also to really be very cautious of who you're listening to this in front of if you're listening out loud. Children should not be in earshot of this episode. This is going to be adult content, and something that we want to make sure we share, because it's so important for so many people to hear about and learn about and gain support from in different ways. But we really want to make sure that it is not being overheard by the wrong ears of people that are too young, or not, it's not appropriate, or not at the right stage of life for them to be hearing about these types of things. So what we're going to be talking about is one of the areas of therapy that I work a lot with is sex addiction. It is not at all an uncommon experience. I've worked with many, many, many men and women who have been dealing with this. And I recently heard a prominent Lakewood therapist say, I don't think he had any hard research on this, but I heard a prominent Lakewood therapist say that for every alcoholic, he thinks there's 10 sex addicts in the Jewish community. It is a very prevalent challenge. What exactly addiction means, and how do you describe addiction? How do you define addiction? We're not going to get into that right now. I don't think that's the topic to get into these nuances of those things, but this struggle is real. Typically, not exclusively at all. I have worked with many situations that were the reverse of this in terms of genders, but typically speaking, it's the husband or the man who is struggling with the sex addiction. And the corollary of sex addiction, which is a topic that is so important that we're going to be looking at both of these tonight or today in this episode, is the betrayal trauma of the spouse who experiences being married to somebody with a sexual addiction, and the trauma that ensues from discovering that, and then the road to repair or the road to dissolving, and what that looks like. And this couple, who we're going to call Moshe and Yael, have really been on a journey that is inspiring and really something that I want to learn more about. And I'm hoping that in our talking together about the experience they've had is something that a lot of people will find a lot of hope and insight and support in getting the help that they need, or finding the strength that they need to build
or rebuild relationships in their lives that can be really meaningful. So thank you both so much for making the time and for the vulnerability and the openness to doing this episode.
Our pleasure.
So I want to start actually by, and we're going to kind of start at a specific juncture and then work backwards and then move forwards. So I want to start by asking Yael what the moment of discovery was for you of what was going on in your life and how you found out and what you found out and what that was like for you.
Okay. So it wasn't discovery, it was actually disclosure. Moshe came to me, probably he came to me in stages. It was, I would say, staggered disclosure. So he first came to me and presented that he has a little problem, but it's okay. It's not an addiction. He spoke to a friend who has an addiction and he has it under control. But sometimes he watches porn. He maybe threw in that occasionally he masturbates also. Until that point, his narrative for me, which looking back, I know doesn't make so much sense, but until that point, his narrative was that he never, ever masturbated. And for whatever reason, I believed him.
How many years into the marriage was this
conversation? About 7.
About 7 years in.
And until that point, I mean, the first few years were, got married very young, so they were decent, okay years, but then it very quickly declined. And at that point, 7 years in, we had no positive relationship. It was a house of stress and tons of financial issues. No, really nothing positive. We also had zero intimate life. Like we maybe were intimate at that point 6 times a year. So when he told me that, he wasn't even saying it as an excuse for why things were bad. It was just, he had this problem. And for me, it wasn't a hard conversation. It wasn't a bad conversation. It was like almost, oh, like, this is a step forward. He's being vulnerable with me. He's disclosed. He cares about me. He values me enough to share something intimate. So I didn't take that in any negative way. And then I think in my memory, I think it was about a month and a half, until over that month and a half, he started giving me more and more that it's not occasionally, it's pretty often, it's all the time. And this is a full-blown addiction. Which he, again, even at that point, until he started therapy and I started to understand what addiction means, it wasn't so hard. And I wasn't really putting it together that this is why things were so hard.
I'm just curious, do you think that anyone looking in at your life at that time would have thought, what would they have thought? You know, what if somebody in the community have known about your life? And did you have kids at that point?
Yeah, we had a few kids. They would have had no clue. He was a very present father. They were little at that point, so he was very helpful in bedtime and homework. And he, on the outside, everything looked perfect. I mean, people knew that we struggled financially, but
sure,
other than that,
model citizens of the community. And
yeah, and I was miserable, and I don't think I let in even one friend or family member.
So for 7 years you were, and then maybe more than that, you were carrying all of this just completely in isolation.
Yeah, and really taking full ownership for it. That it was my problem, it was my fault.
Wow. Is there anything more you can say to that? Meaning, how did you manage? Like, how did you cope? What was that like to be in a marriage for that long?
It was horrific, but it was almost all I knew. Mm-hmm. So I just, and at that point I was working full time. I was just putting one foot in front of the other. It was hellish. I think I cried myself to sleep pretty much every night without fail. I remember once, I have like such a specific memory of standing in the shower and saying over and over and over, I hate him, 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 but not thinking I could do any better. Mm-hmm.
So just before I turn to you, Moshe, to ask you what your experience was at that point and leading up to that point, and then we're going to come back to Yael. I want to just highlight a couple of things, because part of the intention of this episode is to really give people access to resources and just knowledge, access to education on these topics, because what you just described is 7 years of right? Being so alone in that experience of that pain and not knowing what was going on, not knowing what to make of anything. And I think that when the knowledge is put out there for people to be able to access, it can really help people earlier on. So I want to just describe a few different phenomena that you brought up. And what I'm going to describe is my experiences and in the trainings that I've done, the research that I've read and all of that. And they might not be exactly what your experiences were, but some of the things that you brought up so far. The first is the concept of the word that you used, the kind of staggered disclosure. And I want to talk about that because I think it's so important. The experience that most spouses of sex addicts have is what they call staggered disclosure or staggered discovery. And so your case is unique in that Moshe actually came on his own to tell you something. Most of the time it's discovery. So most of the time the spouse, and again, I'm using the gender stereotypes here. So most of the time the wife discovers something in her husband's actions and she confronts him about it. She brings it up. She tries to talk to him about it. And most of the time what happens is that he will admit to as little as he needs to. First, there'll be denial. There'll oftentimes be some gaslighting. There'll be manipulating. There'll be all sorts of things that can happen. But he will eventually, if need be, admit to as little as he needs to in order to get by. But then what happens is that then there's another discovery and another confrontation. And then again, an admitting of as little as it needs to get by. And that'll continue happening until something hits where it becomes clear that, okay, I'm not getting the whole picture here. And the reason that phenomenon is so damaging to the relationship is because now once I've gone through that process of a disclosure or an admitting more than once, but it ended up still not being the truth, now I'm starting from this place of how do I know that I can ever really trust you? Because even what you admit to now, I've had people who have done full what we call therapeutic disclosures, where they give a full voluntary description of all the acting out and all the different addictive behaviors that have been going on. And the spouse listening at the end of it wants to be able to believe all of it because she might see all the growth in her husband and still have this trauma voice of, but still, how do I know that's the whole list? Because I've actually gone through that process with you 6 times already, and each time it ended up not being the whole thing. So still, how do I know it's the whole thing? And so just want to bring this up because it's such an important piece of validation for the trauma and the distrust that can develop from the staggered nature of the way that these things usually unfold. On the side of the person with the addiction, I want to just mention, because I don't want to be talking about this in a way that sounds so vilifying of the person with the addiction. It's completely understandable. Whether it's okay or not is a different question, but it's completely understandable why the person who's being found out is responding in that way, because it's so frightening, it's so scary. And they may have never told anyone in their life about any of it. And how is my spouse going to respond? And what's this going to mean for my life and my kids and everything that I know to be the case? And so I want to just do whatever I need to do to keep everything in place as much as possible. I'll admit to what I need to admit to, and then hopefully things will get better. It's not coming from an evil place. It's coming from a very, very scared and frightened place. So there's a lot more to say on it, but just to highlight that piece about the staggered discovery, staggered disclosure. The other thing I want to just mention, and then we're going to turn to Moshe's part of this story, is what you mentioned of that for all those years, there was almost no intimacy. So there's a concept that's called sexual anorexia that complements or goes together oftentimes with sexual addiction. Sexual addiction is the behavior of acting outside of the relationship in sexual ways. Sexual anorexia is that in the relationship, there's very little intimacy, very little sexual intimacy. And the reason why those two things often go together is because underlying sex addiction so often is what is really can be looked at, not as a sexual addiction, because that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the symptom. What's really going on is an intimacy disorder, is a difficulty with intimacy. And because I don't feel safe, comfortable, lovable, worthy of intimacy, I escape intimacy by finding non-intimate sexuality. And I also escape intimacy by not engaging in actual intimacy with my intimate partner. There's more to say on that too, but just to name that. In some cases, it's more extreme sexual anorexia. In your case, it sounds like it was more extreme sexual anorexia. In other cases, the sexual anorexia can be much more subtle. So it's not that there isn't intimacy or that there's only intimacy 6 times a year, but it's that the intimacy in the relationship is affected in some very significant, but even sometimes subtle way that really is the flip side of the coin of the addiction. So coming back to you guys, so Moshe, for you at that 7 years, like what brought you to, you know, and really a lot of kind of credit to you, as I was just talking about, even when there is discovery of when the spouse finds something and confronts, most people are still denying. But you actually, not only were you not denying when you were confronted, you actually on your own kind of came forward, even if it was in a staggered way, but it was voluntarily by choice. What prompted that? And then you can kind of take us backwards also, but what was going on at that time?
Thinking about this podcast, coming into this podcast, I was trying to do a mental timeline in my head. And I just want to say that I realized I have a very, very murky timeline. And just talking it over with y'all, I realized that my timeline doesn't necessarily match up to her timeline. So I'm just going to say how I remember it. About a year previous to that disclosure, a friend of mine had disclosed to me that he has a problem with sex addiction. And in the process of him telling me that, all of my denial kind of started breaking and my compartmentalism started breaking. And I realized, like, this is my problem. Like, whatever fog I was living in, and we could get to that afterwards, whatever fog I was living in for a long time, like, I see my way out of it. And there was a certain pressure because Yael was, you know, we had gone to therapy, we'd gone to marriage counseling. You know, she had questioned in marriage counseling, like, am I gay? You know, what's going on? I had nothing to say. And there was kind of a pressure of like, this is obviously ending. We're at the last string. We're in the last string. And it was definitely getting to a head. So it was definitely a pressure to like kind of solve the situation. After a few months of trying to figure it out on my own, you know, with my newly armed self-knowledge and discovery, I realized I couldn't. And my problem was actually getting more compounded or worse. And, you know, I'll go into that in a minute. And the need to just spill it out was actually more, you know, was more helpful to me than self-preservation at the moment. And I guess that was a self-preservation. So I just went and spilled it. But again, as I'm spilling it, I even remember as I'm saying it, I'm immediately starting to walk it back. Manipulation started working in, like, I don't want to give away too much information because I need to have these back doors. You know, I need to have this leeway. So if I give too much information, then I'm on the hook too much. And going to therapy and then immediately joining SA, obviously the need and the speed of disclosure sped up.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, what you're saying is something that even when it's cases of discovery versus disclosure is so common that the ability to have the secret out, despite what repercussions may come, for a lot of people ends up being one of the most liberating experiences that they can imagine. And there's a line in the AA or SA world of you're as sick as your secrets, right? Which has a lot of meanings to it. But on one level, it's because just living with the secret can make us so sick. So what can you say more about what it was like hearing your friend describe his sexual addiction issue and what that made you realize? Like, what was the experience of addiction for you that you started realizing was going on?
In the recent years of therapy, I realized I have a disassociation need, and that's been kind of the real addiction. Sex addiction obviously being the vehicle of it. I don't remember much. I don't remember much of my childhood. I really don't remember much details of the first 7 years. I was just felt like I was just struggling to like stay alive in some sense. Every day was just a black cloud. Woke up every single day, hoping not to wake up, staying up as late as possible every single night that somehow I could skip the next day and I figured out the magic code to like fix life. And the next time, just as cliche, the next thing's going to save me. the next image is going to save me, the next video is going to save me, and just tripping through life that way, in a total fog, but also completely compartmentalized and in denial that somebody once made a comment to me about pornography, and I was like, me? And like, I really believed it. Like, I don't do that. Like, that's not me. Like, I had a completely separate, like, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde situation. I couldn't even answer why I wouldn't have an intimate life. Like, I have no idea. Like, I don't know. And when my friend was talking to me, whatever, how he was talking plainly and just being very honest and not even talking about the details, more talking about like the feeling of like, you know, the feeling of being disconnected and the feeling of living in that fog, it just really broke my denial and just reality just peeked in for a few, you know, moments, which was what's needed, thankfully.
Yeah. So there was, it sounds like, tell me if I'm getting this right, that for you, there wasn't really like such an experience of living with guilt those 7 years. It was more just compartmentalized. Like it was, is that accurate?
There was obviously guilt, but somehow it was all in that one closet that I just shoved everything into. Mm-hmm. You know, I was present at home, but I was completely checked out mentally. I wasn't there emotionally at all. I was just there. You know, I was able to change diapers, but like I couldn't give any emotional, you know, shoulder to lean on for anyone around me. Yeah. And that was all, again, just everything was shoved down so deep that it was just, I couldn't access it.
And can you say a little bit more what you mean by, I think I know, because this is kind of in the work that I do, but for anyone else listening, that word dissociation, and you said that the sex addiction was kind of just the vehicle for that, but that was really going on for you was this need for dissociation. What does that mean to you?
It means that for whatever reason, I couldn't deal with real life and I needed to escape. I guess it's really a fancier word to say escape.
Yeah.
I needed to escape from my life. Real life just wasn't doing it for me. Maybe in the beginning it was, I just couldn't handle or cope with the day-to-day stresses of being a responsible adult, husband, father, employee, whatever. And at some point, I guess it was also the guilt compounded that need. So the need to, you know, not feel what I'm feeling from last time, not feeling, continues to compound interest, you know, just waiting, like looming, the tower is looming to collapse on me.
Just so listeners know, because they won't be able to see this, the couple that's talking to me right now is like huddled so close together to try and make sure that the microphone on the shared laptop is picking up both of them. And just listening to this story would be so hard. Like you wouldn't have the visual that I have right now of such a connected and loving and amazing couple. It's just, hopefully we'll have time to get to how that's possible after all this. So one more question for you for the moment, Moshe, and then we'll switch again. Is that dissociation, in my experience, and tell me if it's different for you, but in my experience, typically of working with people with addictions, that need for dissociation or the need for escape, as you're calling it, and most addictive behaviors are typically rooted in some form of trauma, as we call sometimes uppercase T, that there's some objective kind of incident or event, and oftentimes a lowercase T, or what can be called more developmental or complex trauma, meaning that it's not something that someone would look at and be like, oh my God, that's so crazy. It's more that there is environmental factors that were less than nurturing and really led to a buildup of different things in the person's system that therefore they needed to find escapes. Did you, in the work that you've done, kind of discover what that, you know, if that resonates with you, A, and B, if it does, you know, what did you discover as to what your need for dissociation was really rooted in?
So for a long time, I didn't have an answer for that. And it didn't even behoove me to look into it. I was forward facing. In a recent alternative treatment session, what came back to me was just a level of lack of nurturing in my childhood, a real lack of nurturing. As I've described to people, like the situation was like 1,000 scraped knees came back to me at one shot. Like every time that I didn't feel like someone hugged me at the time, or it just allowed me to go continue. Keep going inward, 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 that like I was my own nurturer I was the person that had to, you know, salve my wounds. I was the person that had to take care of myself. Like, my mother was just not there emotionally for me, but it's only a recent realization.
If I could cut in a second, I think it was something that in the beginning of the recovery journey was very disturbing for you. Like, everyone had these big trauma stories.
Right.
And you felt like your life was good. So, like, what's your excuse?
Right. And nothing to point to.
Yeah. And that actually is the added challenge of when the trauma is emotional neglect, that there's nothing to point to. And emotional neglect can be really profoundly impactful and devastating. I actually personally find that in the work that I do, the healing around emotional neglect is oftentimes more challenging than the healing around what sounds to people like crazy trauma stories. If there is good stuff in the system, and then there's this dark spot, there's this difficult event, and we need to work with healing that, but there's a lot of positive in the system, that's one thing. But when there's emotional neglect, it's the system is running on empty. There's no fuel in the tank. And how do you heal that? It's not really about healing, because there's not something to heal. It's more, how do we build something, almost in a sense, that's missing? We're building something from nothing almost. And of course, it never actually is nothing, which is part of the methodology of how we can heal. But that's the starting point. It's really challenging and you know, in the way you're describing, like, it can be confusing, and it's like, what's going on? It takes much longer to realize what the issue actually was. But then pornography, masturbation, any of these things can become, or any other behavior can really fill that void in a very powerful way. And then it becomes so addictive because it actually hit the spot in some way. It actually did something for you. What was the emotional experience for you in trying to then take, you know, steps forward? What was the thinking in terms of, like, what you were going to do next when you found out about this? And or how does your past and any past reflection that you have, you know, now from the work you've done, how do you see that now as to how it informed, you know, the experience that you had? And just to be very clear on this, especially when I'm talking to anybody, but especially when I'm talking to the spouse, I think there's an important nuance to bring up, which is that oftentimes we find that the spouse also had some trauma in the past, and that impacted some of the way that this process unfolded. But that's not to say that the addiction is in any way now tied to being the spouse's fault or something that they caused in any way, shape, or form. It's just more of an understanding of how the dynamic unfolded.
So I'll just discuss a little bit around the hardship of, like, where our marriage was at the point of him telling me. So besides for intimacy being a real issue, Moshe had a way of putting me in my place that I should feel like it's my fault. He had a very active social life. I had less of one. He made me feel like I was too needy for him. And he did that also by really make me feel smaller and smaller as the years went by. So at the point, I know Moshe mentioned that he thought we were going to get divorced. In reality, that was never going to be a possibility because I didn't think that I deserved to be married to anyone who would treat me better. I really viewed myself as such a nothing. And the reason that he was treating me this way was because I was so needy and I was the problem, and it made sense. He had no desire for me. So it was years of manipulation, and I didn't know heads from tails. Like, I didn't know what was right. I really believed I should be treated that way. And like, looking back, I sat in that for so long, and today I can't even imagine that. Like, it doesn't make sense to me how long I put up with what I put up with. And so just to give a little bit of my history, which I believe led me to be able to sit in it for so long, I grew up a middle child, but classic middle child, of not feeling seen, wanting to get attention, wanting to do things to impress people, trying to get people to like me. At the same time, I also grew up with so much shame. As a young child, I sexually explored, experimented, And I had a ton of shame for that. Like, it followed me wherever I went. And then any negative thing that happened in my life after that, I attributed as my punishment for that. So a few years later, as a young teen, I was molested. And again, I took that as he saw that's all you're good for, or that's what you wanted. Or if you're going to do that, how could you be upset that that's going to happen next? So I really carried it all. And I had, again, just this tremendous amount of shame. And I felt like I was walking around like a fraud. Like, if the people in my life, if my friends really knew who I was, if my family really knew who I was, then no one would like me, or no one would even want to be around me. So when, first of all, when I got into marriage with an extremely distorted view of sex, and I had this like narrative that I'm sexually messed up.
Were you approximately in the initial experience of what you described as like just natural childhood exploration experiment?
Probably about 8 years old, and it went on for years.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then as a teenager, and you linked that back to being kind of like a punishment or...
Yeah, like he saw that's what I'm good for. Mm-hmm. That's what I must want. Something about me led him on.
And was there anyone, I mean, I think based on other things you've told me that I probably know the answer to this, but is there anyone who you told about any of this to, or the molestation or anything like that?
Yeah, but yeah, I did tell somebody, and my mother got me into therapy. The problem was, I got so many like PTSD phobias after that, like things that didn't have to do with the molestation still followed me. Like, I was scared to close my eyes in the shower, or I thought people were always following me. I slept with my nightlight on. But I never told the therapist about my childhood experience that I had experimented. And so I was holding this huge amount of shame and never really being open about it. So I couldn't make any progress in therapy. So I went to therapy, but I don't think it did anything. And then I went for like a few months, and then I think like a Yontif came, which broke up the therapy. And like, my mother never scheduled another appointment. And that was it. So yeah, I came already into marriage with this very distorted view. And then when things started to go south, again, I attributed it to me, to the way I was messed up.
How quickly did things, like you're saying, start to go south?
I would say about two, 3 years in.
Oh, okay. So like the first 2 or 3 years of the marriage wasn't like this?
It wasn't like this. It was the normal struggles. I think we both got married very young. Mm-hmm. And had kids pretty quickly. So the normal stress of life, and again, we financially very much struggled. Mm-hmm. But no, it was a pretty like normal-ish sex life. So I couldn't, yeah, it was only about 2-3 years in where it started to go really south.
Was there something that happened or changed at that point?
I mean, I know in the beginning, again, I had a few kids very quickly. So I was either pregnant or nursing, pretty much. So I didn't really have much of an interest in intimacy. So I wasn't noticing that there was a lack there. And I think even in the beginning, Moshe was interested. I was less so.
And the relationship overall, also like outside of physical intimacy?
It was okay. It was pretty okay. Then to further my narrative of being messed up, and again, sitting so alone with it because it was so shameful, was because of my history, sex wasn't enjoyable. I hated sex. But the confusing part was I still wanted it so much from him. We weren't being intimate. And now I can look back and understand that I was really seeking validation and to see that he loved me and that he was my partner and that he cared about me and he wanted me in his life. But then it was, I don't enjoy sex, but I want to have sex. What the heck is wrong with me? Like, how messed up are you that you're trying for something and you keep pushing and you keep asking for something that's not even good?
And you mentioned before that before the disclosure, there were attempts at marriage therapy, or I don't know, maybe individual therapy. What were those like? I mean, without the information of other things going on, like what was going on in those therapy sessions?
The typical therapy session was y'all talking on and on. I feel like I hope I'm not doing this here. Talking on and on about the problem, and me just being completely silent. And just kind of allowing or hoping that the therapist understand that she's shrill and that I'm cool, you know, and because I also had nothing to add. Like, I had nothing to add. Like, I'll cop to, you know, if you say something specific, I'll cop to it. For all my real problems, I didn't even, wasn't even in touch with. So how could I expect a third party to like scratch the surface?
We went for about 6 months, I think, right, for marriage counseling. And then at one point, Moshe told me it's not helping, it's not working, he's not coming anymore. And then so I continued to see the therapist alone.
Yeah. And Moshe, the description you gave me before of like this, you know, staying up super late, hoping to not wake up the next morning and all that, like that wasn't something that you shared in the therapy. It was like you didn't connect that at all, or?
I don't believe that I had the capabilities of, you know, tapping into that at the time. It never even occurred to me, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it kind of, you know, makes sense in a kind of, you know, upside down way, but makes sense. Yeah. So tell me now, if you guys can, either one of you could take this to start out. Like, what was the road? Okay, so we talked a bit, obviously there's so much more to say on everything, but we talked a bit about background. We talked about the stage of when things kind of came to the surface. And then what happened next? What was the road to recovery? What did that look like in the beginning? Maybe Moshe, maybe you can talk about, you know, your own just recovery from the addiction itself, what that looked like, and then and then, you know, we can shift it over also into like to the relationship, how you what that was like for both of you.
So I definitely had the luxury and the blessing from God to have tried for about like 10 months on my own to heal myself. So when someone told me about the 12-step meetings, I already walked in. I was primed to accept. I'd already gone through the pitfalls of thinking that I knew better, or that I can't listen to what someone's telling me to do. I was so desperate and just beaten down by life and my own issues that I walked in like, I'm ready to receive, like, tell me what to do. And like most people that come in for the first time, the sense of relief of seeing that you're not alone and that other people get you and you're not crazy, like that alone is probably 50% of the healing, of the shame healing. You know, the real healing was a very much longer process. I definitely stayed in that 50%, feeling less shameful, going through the mechanics of the program for a long time, but continued to go through, you know, went through the program, continued to go regularly. We attended some couples meetings, we attended some weekends. We both started working with therapists alone, intensive therapy, weekly therapy, finally able to get in touch with the truth, or whatever my version of the truth at that time was, and continue to really dig deep, and just a commitment to making this work. It wasn't difficult for me. I thankfully had a pretty smooth ride when it came to battling the problem. I had a much harder time dealing with the problems that I left in my wake. But the day-to-day struggle of addiction was not a big battle for me. Again, maybe it's because I tried hard. I just had some sort of resolution.
Like the 10 months you described, like how long ago was that?
From today, about 15 years ago.
15 years. So, and for all 15 years, would you say that relatively, like the addiction part of it, not the whole picture, but the addiction part of it has not been particularly challenging?
It's reared its head over the years a few times, in different periods of time, but overall it has not been a massive battle. And I know that's an anomaly and unique to myself, and I'm grateful for it.
I find there's a mix. I mean, probably I would say what you're describing in my experience seems to be the minority, but not an unfound minority. I mean, some people, right, once the secret is lifted, and they actually get the community of support and help and resources and all that, the addiction itself needs to be continued to be, you know, looked at and taken care of, right, but it's not it's not like a day-to-day, you know, battle and a kind of impossible uphill. For a lot of people, it continues to be a very profound struggle.
I think you touched on it with the community. I think that there's a big issue and pitfall in the insular community of the meetings of what the mentality is of people around you. And the people that you associate with in there could make or break your life. And if you're dealing with people who are not just practical, but also have the longer game in mind of, I'm not here to be great at program. I'm not here to just be a master of the 12 steps. I'm not here to make friends and fellowship. I'm here to move forward. I'm here to move forward. And if you're surrounding yourself with people like that, or talking to you and giving you the truth back, that makes it that much easier because we're all committed to going forward. Now, how do we get there forward? As opposed to people who are just stumbling along and just happy with the fellowship. And like I said, happy with not feeling in the shame, but they never progress.
Yeah. You were about to say that. So that wasn't your biggest challenge, but you were going to say that for you, the challenge was something else.
Biggest challenge was self-awareness. Biggest challenge was empathy and really dealing with the family system and dealing with people around me and how to interact with that. You know, it really took me a long time to get out of that. You know, I walk into the meeting the first day and I'm still taking all my garbage with me and I'm just superimposing it onto another system. So like, I'm being a jerk to people in the meetings, you know, I'm talking down to people in the meetings. I'm trying to get my way. I'm over talking them. I'm trying to make them feel little, all the same things. I'm walking in with that. My manipulations are walking in with me as well. The bigger challenge was fixing myself. But, you know, like I said, the addiction process, that thankfully has been at bay for about 14 years now.
That's a really profound and important point, because I think what you're talking about in, you know, in some terminology people might use is the difference in abstinence and sobriety, right? Where abstinence is I'm not doing the behavior. That part of it was challenging, but not particularly challenging for you. But sobriety or recovery or healing or growth, whatever you want to call it, is a whole different game. And the addiction, again, is really just the tip of the iceberg to what's really going on in an emotional and interpersonal level.
Yeah, it's easy to get fooled by day counts and, you know, being part of a certain chevra. And, you know, it's very easy to fall into that. And again, thankfully, I walked in the first day and there was a group of people that I'm still in touch with on a regular basis. And they had their heads screwed on straight and they were looking for the same goals I was looking to. And thankfully, that has coasted us. You know, it coasted me to where we are today.
How did you and how do you continue working on empathy, self-awareness, you know, to, I guess, in your own words, you know, not being a jerk, not talking down to people? Like, how do you work on that?
A lot of it comes from just being open to feedback, you know, being open to listening to y'all specifically and trying to take what she's saying as constructive feedback for the future, not being defensive. And a lot of it comes from therapy, you know, and dare I say, you know, Torah, Musar, Chassidus.
Yeah. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Like with the history that you gave us before, that was where a lot of your struggle was, particularly empathy, because the trauma, so to speak, was emotional neglect. That's really the key. We do to ourselves what was done to us. And then we do to others what we're already doing to ourselves. So if I've never gotten empathy, I don't give myself empathy. And if I don't give myself empathy, I'm not giving others empathy.
And can I say, in contrast to his maybe easy beginning journey, that first year in program, because I joined, he joined SA and I joined SMA probably a month later, which I fought. I didn't want to be one of them. It would solidify that this is our problem. But that once I saw that I just couldn't do it alone, I joined the 12-step group. That year was excruciating for me. If I look back, I would say it maybe was even harder than living in addiction with him as an addict. Because he struggled with the empathy part, he was just very matter of fact, like, we're going to do this step, then this step, and we'll hear from one person, how they were doing it and it was working for them. And so he'd come home and he would say, this is how we have to implement it. He was learning about codependency and he didn't really know what that meant and what that meant in bringing it to and working on it and healing. To him, it meant stay away. Like, I'm not going to share things with you. My program and my journey in recovery is my journey. You go do your thing. But that wasn't reality. And so I was just in another way, almost even more alone. And he would tell me, like, very matter-of-factly, like, yeah, of course I wasn't nice to you, or of course I acted that way. I didn't love you. Or, like, I don't love you. I'm learning how to love you, but I don't love you. We'll get there. Like, that's the goal. And so I had this, like, which is the biggest pain of my life. Like, I grew up, I just wanted to be as important, as special as the youngest in my family, or I just wanted to be loved. And so to hear it from him, like, so matter of fact, yeah, I just don't love you. Like, it was an excruciating year for me. I probably had most growth in that short period of time, but it was extremely hard.
What did the therapy look like in that for you in that context, in terms of, like, your individual work? What were you quote unquote working on? I know in terms of the, let's say, the 12 steps. So there's, you know, there's a lot of community, a lot of support, and there's the 12 steps. But in the individual therapy, what was that?
So it's actually really hard. And knowing what I know now, I understand it a little bit. I wasn't seeing a therapist who was familiar with addiction. I just continued seeing the same therapist that we saw first as a marriage counselor and then continued alone. I don't think he led me in the right direction. He was telling me to play hard to get, pretty much. It really wasn't helpful. What was helpful was a year in. So we didn't start marriage counseling again until a year into our recovery. We each did our own journey. He was with his therapist. I was with mine, again, who wasn't an addiction therapist. But then we started seeing an addiction therapist together a year in. And I was getting so much more understanding and personal gains from the marriage counseling that I was getting in my own personal therapy that I eventually switched to an addiction therapist. It was hard work. I really had to learn how to build myself up to see that I had value, but I had to see it for myself. I always say, and when newcomers come to Essanon meetings now, I always tell them, like, I walked into those doors, like, if you would have touched me, I would have fell down. Like, that's how weak I felt. That's how incapable I felt. Like, I would not be able to get through any challenge. And the confidence, even just experiencing it and making it through another day, just built me up. Like, I was doing the work. I was showing up. I was doing what I was told. I looked at people who were in the program a lot longer for me, and I asked their guidance, and I saw how they did things. And just the content, I just saw it just naturally. Like, I wasn't so good with 12 steps. Like, I didn't make it through the whole way. But I gained so much just being a part of that fellowship and asking questions and following through. And that I don't resemble the person that walked in that door a bunch of years ago.
You don't seem like a person that if someone touched you, fall over.
Now she would push back.
What was your home like during that time? Like, what was, how did your kids, did your kids know any of this, or are they, you know, I mean, everyone's affected by everything in any sort of way, but how would you talk about that?
We definitely grew up in a chaotic home. We also, one of our children has special needs. So it was chaotic and hard just because of that in itself. But we weren't dealing with it properly, and we were taking it out on each other, like, before program. So they definitely felt the chaos. It wasn't a settled home. And then over the years, it definitely improved. We joke that we have recovery puzzles that we didn't know how to be in a relationship with each other when we first joined. So I remember, and our kids, they were young enough that on late Friday nights, they would go to sleep before, I think even before Shabbos. So it would just be the two of us. And so we would do these puzzles, like these 1,000-piece puzzles, without saying, in the beginning, we didn't even know how to have a conversation that didn't include recovery. Like, we could talk about the problem, we could talk about, like, what we were experiencing at that moment, but that's all we knew how to talk about. And so we would just sit there quietly and do puzzles together. And slowly, like, naturally, over time, conversation came in. And we had a bunch of puzzles that we did during that time. Another piece that we didn't touch on is religiously, a path that I don't know if it's popular, but it does tend to happen from what we see, is a lot of times the addict will sort of drop the religious piece in order to build themselves back up, whether they have religious trauma, and Moshe could speak on that a little bit. I married a kolo boy. Like I was followed the typical yeshiva, the sabbatical path, and I wanted to raise a family that way. And then all of a sudden he was dropping everything. And he didn't outright do any like aviros, but he stopped going to minyan. It was just not like Yiddishkeit was not present. But what we did discuss that we both agreed on was that we want to get there. He wants to get there. He's not there now, and we don't want to confuse our children. So we were sending our children to yeshivas and bisakos, and if they're learning that the tati stays up on Shavuos night all night to learn Torah, they're going to see their tati do that, even if he's really just leaving until they go to sleep. Or Friday night, he would go for a walk around the block a few times. Actually, he used to meet with program people Friday nights. And then he would come home, and then we just made it like this nice thing where we got him to call Shabbos together as a family. But they thought he went to shul first. And that's sort of how we slowly over the years, and Baruch Hashem, Yiddishkeit's flowing.
Yeah. Can you say more, Moshe, about, you know, where Yiddishkeit is now for you, and, you know, kind of how that evolved through this process?
Just to touch on what y'all was saying, there is some sort of pervasive movement of like, maybe once upon a time, there was a guy with religious trauma, and they kind of like handed down the Masorah that being in 12 steps is the opposite. Like, you can't possibly be worried about Yiddishkeit and recover at the same time. So one of them has to go, and obviously this is what's important right now. And I drank the Kool-Aid. I drank the Kool-Aid. And looking back, because it's easy, because who wants to be from, you know, because who wants to be worried about things? And it was just simple, and I just didn't revisit it for years. And I just kind of remembered last year that didn't work for me, so it just didn't work for me again. But thankfully, through the grace of God, the Spirit moved me. You know, it started speaking to me again through kumzitz, actually through singing, and just started permeating my life. And a big leap that actually, you know, really ties, I think, a lot of the story together is at some point, as self-awareness continued to grow, as I think, well, I could speak for myself and self-awareness and coupleship awareness grew, at some point there was this understanding from my part that a relationship with God is a relationship with my wife, and that is the path. And from there, it skyrocketed. You know, from there it became, if I don't have the best relationship I could possibly have with my wife, how could I assume to have the best relationship with something that I can't even fathom? And that really, in the last few years, has really grew and grew and grew and continues to grow. Continues to be the brightest light in my life is our relationship. And I'm very excited to see where we're going from here. But it involves just being as present as I can when it comes to, you know, religious practices, and looking for more and looking to understand more. And a big joy is finding a lot of the principles that I thought were so unique to program in the Torah, and seeing a lot of that, and understanding also that my journey of not going through Yiddish, of taking Yiddishkeit away, was also a Hashgacha Pratis. I don't think I could have a love if I had not removed it first and then put it back in.
Yeah, I think your whole story on a macro level, and then what you just described kind of on like a micro level, you know, is one that just screams of the concept that we know of theoretically, and I think we all long for in so many situations, but we don't always get to really see it firsthand. And to me, spending this time with you guys, I can like feel it in my body, like to the point of like goosebumps when you just said that the brightest light in your life is your wife and your marriage. Like the 180 of that from the beginning of the story we started with is just incredible, and speaks to the concept. What I was going to say is it speaks to the concept of how when we go through these impossibly difficult times, they often end up getting us to a place that we never would have been able to get to had we not, right? Which still doesn't mean we ever want to choose to be in those situations. It's kind of the paradox of it, but it really is the reality of how people change and how people grow. So I guess in finishing off our time, I'm curious to ask you both if you had any particular advice that you would want people who are listening, who Moshe, you could maybe speak to, if there's a guy out there or someone who thinks they might have some level of addiction, whether it's full-fledged addiction or not. We're not getting, again, as I said, we're not getting into the differences there, but somebody who's struggling with something, it might be sex addiction, or it could be any kind of more secret compulsive behavior that he's living with or she's living with and struggling. If there's a message you would want them to know from your experience, if there is a message you would want the spouse of someone who's struggling, if there's a message of advice or support that you would want them to hear from your experience, what would you each share?
First, to the struggling person or the person that's contemplating if they're an addict or not, I'll say what someone said in the first meeting. They said, people who are not addicts don't spend the whole day thinking if they're addicts or not. So if you think you have a problem, you should probably get that checked out. As a point of advice, I would say is aim higher. You could always aim higher. This is just because, you know, people make a glass ceiling for themselves when it comes to recovery, when it comes to marriage. I think that they should just know there's better out there and it's possible. You don't have to settle.
I guess my point of advice is don't do it alone. Like, there are so many people that can relate to you, that you can relate to. You're not so unique. Share it. When I look back, the saddest part for me is how much shame and how alone I was in my struggle. And as soon as I started opening up, I know that in the tall steps, there's I know it's for SAS Non, I think it's with the other tall steps as well. There's a meeting called a qualification where somebody shares their story. And when I qualified for my meeting, I knew I couldn't share my story without giving my childhood story, without giving the things that I was most ashamed over. And I remember my therapist before I shared at that meeting, my therapist told me she would love to be a fly on that wall, because she said, you have no idea how many people are going to be able to relate to your story. And I shared in front of, I think there were 45 people by that meeting. And I think over half the people in that room came over to me and told me later on, some right away and some over time, how they related to specific parts of my story. Like, and each part was referenced. So, and I remember as I gave over that qualification, a feeling like I was floating. It was taking this huge boulder off my shoulder. Like, I literally, and I think I even voiced that while I was giving my qualification. It was the best feeling to not be alone, to let go of that shame. And then we're all just trying to do our best.
Would you say that you each experienced healing from the childhood experiences that you brought into the marriage because of this painful experience that kind of forced you to have to look at that and see that?
100%. I always say, like, each of us, I think, without having married the other or faced these specific challenges, could have probably coasted. It could have been okay. And this forced us to have to deal with it. I don't have any shame. Like, I am so proud of our journey, because we were talking before we did this podcast and we were saying a little bit over we were reviewing our story a little together. And he called me and he said, I just want to tell you that I was thinking this morning, I just see you. Like, I see you, I know you, and I feel bad that I was a part of that pain, but like, I see it. And that just was just so validating and meaningful. And I didn't have to like fix it. Like, no, it wasn't her fault. It was, no, we're just here. We're just so proud of what we've been through and how we've come out of it. And our relationship is for sure the proudest thing I have in my life. It is. It's the light of my life. It's the joy. It's my roundedness. It's my everything.
Amazing. Thank you so much. If either of you has any last word you want to share, you have another minute or two, but thank you. Thank you both so much for sharing this. Thank you for bringing this light into the world. And I hope that this will really bring a lot of people education, resources, motivation, and support to do whatever they have to do to really, we should all only be so fortunate as to get to where you both got and got together. It's just really, really inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity. I wish that when we were in the journey, like knowing other people also experienced and there is help out there. So thank you. And if there's anyone that we can help, they could reach out to you and we're here.
That's amazing. Yeah. So just to speak that out, if anybody's listening to this and would want to be in touch with Moshe or Yael in their real form, you can reach out to me and I will check with them if I can connect you guys. And that's a really generous offer. Thank you for making that offer.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both.
I'm recording this postscript a few days after doing the episode with Moshe and Yael, and I'm finding myself still emotionally moved from the conversation with them, and particularly the ending of our conversation and seeing them. I had the opportunity to be able to actually see them as we were discussing, and not only listen to them, but to really hear the incredible healing and connection that they were able to discover within themselves and with each other, and the growth and finding such a sense of fulfillment specifically through their marriage, which was at the beginning the source of so much pain and so much difficulty. And I think that this story is so important in so many ways. There are a number of aspects that I want to just mention that we didn't get to speak about. We didn't speak about the disclosure process in terms of how, in a therapeutically supported way, Moshe disclosed the details and specifics, the relevant information of his addictive behaviors to Yael, and how she went about hearing that and being able to hold herself and live through that process, and what it was like for him to share all of that, and why that's an important process in this context at times, not always, how to understand that, how to know when it is the right thing to do, how to do it properly, and hearing from them about that part of the process, we did not have a chance to go into. We also didn't have a chance to discuss the specifics of what made Moshe's experience in addiction and why it was so damaging and so troubling. In his case, based on a private conversation I had with him, the level of pornography and masturbation use was actually quite extreme. There are many other situations where it may not be as extreme as in his case, but still very, very problematic. There are other situations where a person's behavior is not limited to online and self-pleasuring, but it may involve other people or more outside of the marriage activities that can be in some ways possibly even more difficult for the spouse to experience or to hear about and learn about. In their situation, there was what we called sexual anorexia within the marriage, meaning there was less intimacy in the marriage while there was more intimacy outside the marriage. But oftentimes, and that is common, but oftentimes in situations of sexual addictions, there is this outside of intimacy, hypersexuality, and also within the marriage, there can be a lot of pressure on sexual behavior and sexual expectations. And there can be a lot of things where it's not that there's an expectation, that there's anorexia around sexuality. It's not that there is less physical sexual activity in the marriage, but there's less what we'd call intimacy through sexuality in the marriage, because the sexual addiction turns the spouse of the person with the addiction into an object, a sexual object. And so there's a loss of that seeing the other and recognizing their needs and their feelings and having a joint intimate sexual experience, because sexuality has become this addictive behavior that affects the person with the addiction so much, and that plays itself out not only in the behaviors and the pursuits outside their marriage, but also within the marriage as well. So just again, naming kind of how there are so many different ways that this can show up, and Moshe and Yael's story is not the only version of this. There are a variety of ways that this happens and plays itself out. But again, still hearing their story and the themes that it brings to light can hopefully be helpful and reflective for each person in their own way. But I think what's really important and part of in our reflection in a conversation after the episode that Moshe and Yael and I had, it may have actually been better to leave out these details, because we wouldn't want, and this was really the reflection that Moshe and Yael shared with me, We wouldn't want anyone to hear this episode and think, well, they were able to do it because maybe their situation wasn't as bad, or maybe they were able to get through it because of X, Y, or Z. Because the reality is that if we're trying and if we believe in it and we want to make it work, there are no guarantees. And some situations do, unfortunately, have to end in part ways. And sometimes that ends up being what's best for everyone. But people really can find hope. And the hope that we had in recording this episode was that people can realize that there are resources, there is support, and there is possibility of healing. There's no guarantee, but there is possibility. And the belief in that possibility opens new pathways and new possibilities and opportunities for all of us. And so we really hope that everyone listening to this can find some opening for new light and the ability to really focus in on their own healing and the healing of their marriage and their relationships and growing to the place that ultimately all of us want to be, which is to be living with the people closest to us with much deeper attachment and much more fulfilling and meaningful sources of emotional connection and spiritual connection and physical connection, and to really be able to live, I think, in the way that Moshe said at the end of the episode, that his relationship and his wife is his light, is the light in his life. And what a beautiful way for us, even this episode is being recorded and shared in the weeks leading up to Hanukkah, but to think of Hanukkah as a holiday that's so focused on family. It was a family that actually defeated the Greeks. And the mitzvah of Hanukkah, of lighting the Hanukkah candles, is a mitzvah that's on each family, each household. And so really bringing the light, that light of our lives, and seeing that light in each other and in ourselves. Thank you for listening.